Hello and welcome to the inaugural edition of a series of podcasts about higher education in the United States. Today's topic is the economic rationale for college. Is it worth it? I'm Jody Enda. With me today, Richard Vedder. Richard is director of the Center for College Affordability and Productivity, which researches issues of rising costs and stagnant efficiency in higher education. He also is Distinguished Professor of Economics at Ohio University and an adjunct scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. And he was a member of the so-called Spellings Commission on the Future of Higher Education, which came out with a big report in 2006. Richard is our special guest today. Also with me is Jim Boyle. Jim has been president of the College Parents of America since 2003. A native of Detroit, Jim was part of the first generation in his family to attend college, utilizing a mix of grants, work study, income, and federal student loans. After graduating from Northwestern University, Jim worked on Capitol Hill and in the media, financial services, and advertising. He now is a full-time advocate for millions of current and future college parents. And we have Steve Goodman. Steve is an international authority on college and graduate school admissions. Over the past 20 years, Steve has designed admission strategies for more than 1,700 applicants to colleges, graduate programs, business, law, and medical schools. He coaches students and families on the college search and application process, helping them with school selection, application strategies, and personal statement preparation. His book, College Admissions Together, It Takes a Family, is one of the most referenced college guides for both parents and librarians. Steve has long been a proponent of universities using more of their endowment funds to reduce tuition charges. Welcome, Jim, Steve, and Richard, our special guest. Let's start off talking about the cost of colleges. How do you know when a particular college is worth the cost?
Well, Jody, and by the way, it's delightful to be here with Jim and Steve, who are two of the giants in higher ed, doing what needs to be done in higher ed, which is to focus on the needs of the consumer. Too long in higher ed, we ignore the consumer, we ignore the student, who should be the focus of American colleges and universities. So to me, these are two mini heroes of mine, and I'm delighted to be here with you. Now, a typical college professor, you ask me a question and I answer a different one. How do we know whether college is worth its cost? Well, I guess a simple answer is you know when the person involved graduates and gets a job. That's one way to put it. And that is one of the criteria that we use. There are several factors that are into this. Are the student happy with the college experience? Is the student progressing satisfactorily educationally? And there is the vocational dimension, but the vocational dimension isn't the only dimension. So there's no easy formula to say, is the college worth its cost? And there's a lot of colleges, of course, that are very, very expensive that deliver relatively little. And so the students who go to those schools know it usually pretty soon along the way. I'll stop there and let my colleagues jump in.
Well, and I think the way to look at that is to look at think about what your objectives are. Is your objective to go to the University of ABC in order to get a job? Or is the objective to position yourself for graduate school? Or is it to simply find yourself some friends or a husband or a wife or however you look at it? And of course, the reason this is a little bit of a difficult question is because it's a little bit of a moving target. Not everybody's clear about what their objectives are going in, and sometimes people change their objectives along the way. And interestingly, moms and dads don't always have the same objectives that their kids do, and mothers and dads don't always have the same objectives as one another. So it's a little bit of a complicated question, but I generally tend to agree with Richard's analysis there. I think how people get jobs and whether they get jobs makes a lot of sense. But I also think that there's a value of whether or not people have developed intellectually and whether or not they're better thinkers, they're deeper thinkers, and whether they can now contribute meaningfully to our society. And I think that's my first cut at that.
That was Steve Goodman. Let's go to Jim.
Yes. Well, I think I echo Richard and Steve's comments in many ways. I also would reference the fact when it comes to this issue of the vocational value of college, many parents are very focused on one question. What will my child earn when they graduate from this particular school? Number one, sometimes that number is very hard to obtain. The schools don't necessarily do a great job of following their graduates and tracking their careers and what they earn in order to be able to provide that information to families. But I would also argue that students and parents should focus on a second question, and that is, what will they learn? Because what they learn in school will stay with them, presumably, for the remainder of their lives. It will ultimately impact what they will earn. And if they take the long view and look at their career as a series of steps, which will probably be on a very circuitous path in which the stats show that they will be working in many different jobs over the course of their lifetime, then there should be this, I think, dual purpose of, you know, where will they start out in terms of their career? Will they be given opportunities that are very practical to get in the workforce with something, with some income coming in to start to pay back those student loans? But then, you know, over the course of their career, will their college education inform them no matter what they decide to do with their job?
So beyond paying back the loans and getting some cost benefit out of it, how do you balance the value of something like, say, a liberal arts education with training in a specific field that's more likely to lead to employment?
That's the $64 question. You use the term costs and benefits. And as an economist, we are fond of talking about costs and benefits. But the and both Steve and Jim picked up on this. The benefits of going to the costs are they're kind of hidden before you apply to college, and that's a maddening issue to all three of us. But at some point along the way, you do learn what how big the check is you're going to write. So the costs are fairly easy to measure. The benefits are a little more elusive. And the benefits come in two forms. They come in the form of what we might call consumption benefits. That is, college as a something that we enjoy. Part of it is for social reasons, socialization reasons, you know, parties and all the stuff that go along with going to college. Part of it, though, is learning, reading great books and things that later in life will provide a lot of insight and help you in evaluating issues, but don't have an immediate vocational benefit. And part of the benefits are the vocational benefits of college. So it is a dual thing. College is both a consumption good and an investment good. And so you need to balance both things. I'm a great believer in liberal arts education. I really am. I think we've excessively vocationalized higher ed a bit. But practically, graduates of universities make 50, 75, 100% more than graduates of high school. So we have to balance both of these. And different tastes for different folks. Some people, the investment dimension dictates, and others the consumption. If you're from a family with $100 million and you're going to go work in the family business, maybe you can go to college to enjoy yourself, maybe. But there aren't very many of those families. So it varies from different people.
That was Richard Vetter, director of the Center for College Affordability and Productivity. Jim, do you want to jump in here?
Sure. I think the Richard hit these points head on. I mean, I think what parents are concerned about today, when it with respect to undergraduate education, is the fact that what really is the value of that college degree, or should they be more focused on it as a stepping stone to a graduate degree, because then that in turn can be a great differentiator in terms of income, in terms of career opportunities, in terms of networking, all the things that maybe in the parents' generation a college degree helped them to attain, and they may today assume that a college degree will do the same for their son or daughter. You know, I think a real question out there is that the case? Or is this tremendous cost that's being undertaken to pay for college really just paying for a stepping stone, and that the graduate degree, which of course adds even more to the cost, will be the true differentiator?
And I think I want to talk to jump off on the cost issue. And to put this in some context, because I don't think a lot of people realize this when they start this process, is that if a gallon of milk had risen in cost or in price since 1990 at the same rate as tuition, a gallon of milk would now be $15. And so if you think about this in terms of the absolute cost, not only for undergrad, but as Jim just alluded to a moment ago in terms of graduate school, I think we're pricing families into a position where they now have to make a serious economic decision. Richard a moment ago alluded to the family who had $100 million. And yes, that's probably true for families that don't have that have $100 million. They don't have to worry about this, but everybody else does, because the prices are just simply so staggering that, unfortunately, the beauty and the value of the liberal arts degree in up on the mountaintop has to be now evaluated in terms of cost.
Well, Steve, let me turn that back on you. Can you explain why tuition has gone up so rapidly?
Well, it depends who you ask. There are two schools of thought on that. One is that university costs have gone up simply because states have cut appropriations. I look at it a little bit differently. I think the costs have gone up because universities can raise the costs. And we have one of the premier economists in the country, but I'll let me take a crack at this first. I think that universities have charged the tuition they do because they can, in the same way that you can charge a lot of money for an expensive car because certain people want to pay a lot for an expensive car. We simply see these astronomical increases in tuition simply because students perceive and families perceive that they have nowhere else to go. Now, that's, in my mind, now, of course, everybody always says, well, that's so simplistic. Well, certainly there's been some cost cuts in state appropriations, and then that's true. But there's an arms race going on where universities build nicer and nicer dorms, nicer and nicer facilities, and somebody has to pay for these things, and those costs are turned to the students and families.
Well, let's turn this over then to Richard Vedder.
Well, Steve hit most of the points here. I wrote a 250-page book on it. I'm writing another one, which will have me completely written out of the higher education establishment. He's right. University in the 19th century, there were railroad baron tycoons who monopolists, robber barons, they were called, who said, charge what the traffic will bear. And that's kind of, in some sense, colleges are the 21st century robber barons who are, again, charging what the traffic will bear. And by and large, that's what they do. Why do they charge what they do? Because they can get away with it, basically. And they can get away with it because we have a system that has an enormous reservoir of goodwill towards higher education. Not everyone, but almost everyone in America believes higher education is a good and noble thing. And it is a good and noble thing. I've been a college professor for 45 years. I love it. And I think I'm doing a good thing. But we get away with murder in higher education. We've had enormous growth in staffing of non-instructional nature. We publish 2 million journal articles a year as faculty members, most of which no one ever reads. There have been 22,000 articles written on William Shakespeare since 1985, and I'll bet you most of them haven't been read by anyone of any importance. Now, I'm not against research. I'm not against having diversity programs and all this, but we've lost focus of the core mission of universities, which is educating students, mostly undergraduate students, but to some extent graduate students as well. I could go on and on, but time doesn't permit, so I'll let – and I know Jim Boyle is sitting here, I'm sure, wanting to throw in a few words on this, so I'll shut up.
All right, Jim, well, you're up.
A couple points to buttress what has already been said. It's this – you know, it's supply and demand. It's what students learn in Economics 101. There is a relatively fixed supply of seats available at traditional four-year colleges in the United States, and there is a tremendous demand for those seats – because of two factors. One, you know, as Richard just stated, there's this allure of higher education and a great deal of goodwill attached to it. And so it's become sort of acceptable. You definitely want your child to go to college. And there actually is a bubble of numbers of students coming through the system right now. My son is part of the graduating class of 2010. It is neck and neck with last year's class, 2009, for being the largest in U.S. history. And despite the cost, a greater number of those students desire to attend college, And so that creates this application bubble. The schools know that these students want their places. They are competing, in the case of state schools, with a lot of priorities that state legislators are distracted by, such as Medicare and paying for roads and all that. And when a state legislature then looks at the higher education situation, one can understand why they don't really see it as a crisis. They say, well, there's so many more applications to, you know, fill in the blank state university. Do, you know, people are willing, seem willing to pay these costs. So do we really need to subsidize it more? Probably not. And then you have these tremendous costs that universities get weighed down with that have already been alluded to as well. And so that cost is then passed on to the end user, the consumer, the student, and their parents.
So is the end anywhere in sight? Are prices, is tuition going to still continue to skyrocket, or is there maybe a tipping point here someplace?
I think there is no end in sight, in the sense that there's nothing on the scene right now that's going to change the situation. But I think both of my colleagues here have alluded to the fact that you can't raise the price of something forever faster than people's incomes are going up. There was a time when a family might spend 10% of their family income sending a kid to college, and now then it became 20, and then it became 30%. And now it's in many cases becoming 60 or 70 or 80%. And when you're writing checks that over the course of not 4 years, but very often 5 or 6 years, that's one of the scandals of higher ed is that most kids don't graduate in 4 years. So let's say over 6 years, you're writing checks at a private school amounting to $250,000. You are at a point where price resistance is finally rising out of desperation. People have maxed out on student loans. We're hearing cases of people who are in enormous despair because they've run up these huge debts. And I think at some point we're going to have to find a new way of doing things. It's going to come slowly. And with colleges are going to kick and scream about it. They're not going to go along. That's why these guys, Steve and Jim, are so great, because they're out there putting the pressure on, as I am, to try to get them to move to a new model, or at least to a revision of the current model.
Well, what's the relationship, Steve, between endowments, financial aid, and rising tuition?
Unfortunately, not enough. I think, in my view, what universities do is they simply take the money and sock it away for a rainy day, and that rainy day, of course, never comes.
You're talking about endowments here.
Right, I'm talking about endowments. So what universities do is they take endowments, and I know my two colleagues here have Northwestern ties, and one of the things that I think listeners might be interested to know, that Northwestern's endowment is about the GDP of the Republic of Macedonia, and about twice the GDP of Barbados. Now, Northwestern is a lovely school, and I think Chicago is a lovely city, but should Northwestern have more money in its pocket than Barbados? That's a questionable question. And so why isn't Northwestern using more of that money to pay down what students are paying to go to Northwestern University? That's one question, one point. And the other point I wanted to play off of something that Richard just said a second ago, which is he alluded to the fact that not everybody graduates in 4 years. Well, actually, only 54% of students end up getting a degree within 6 years. So we're now using in the United States a benchmark of 6 years for a four-year school. Now, let's think about that for a second. That's a little crazy, if you ask me. So the benchmark for a four-year school is now 6 years. And even with that incredibly loose definition of a new benchmark, we're only succeeding at 54% of the time. So something tells me, so we have Northwestern and other schools, and I don't mean to pick on Northwestern. Other schools are basically socking the money away, not spending it on students. Students are going to the universities, borrowing money, and then somehow the students aren't even graduating in a timely fashion. And this is costing a lot of money to a lot of families. And so from my perspective as a college advisor, I have to make sure that my students and families are really certain about what they're getting when they get to the University of ABC, because it can be very costly to them if they end up at the wrong school.
Is it the university's fault that the students aren't graduating sooner? Is it the students' fault, or did it just happen?
Well, that's a fair question. I mean, it's a lot of people's fault. I mean, the students bear obviously some responsibility. The universities bear some responsibility. Society bears some responsibility because now the pressure is on. There's very little pressure to say that I have to graduate within 4 years. So I think we all collectively share some of that responsibility.
So, Jim, can you talk a little bit about the value of expensive private universities compared to public schools?
Well, sure. I mean, first of all, I ate a lot of mystery meat when I was at Northwestern, and now I know that it was Macedonian beef, and the reason it tasted so funny. The value of a private education versus public, I think part of it can be explained through the graduation rates and through the number of years it takes to graduate. At the risk of sounding like a spokesman for private schools, that is certainly the case that they would make, that because of the smaller classes, both in whole as well as the individual class attention and advisor attention, that a student can better stay on track toward graduation and is therefore more likely, I don't have the stats at the tip of my fingers, but more likely to graduate within 4 years, thereby perhaps in effect saving a year or two of tuition and somewhat equalizing the cost. Secondly, would be the fact that a great deal of financial aid is available at some private schools that have the endowment, have the ability to afford it, and that also is an equalizer when it comes to cost. So to mention Northwestern again, when I went to Northwestern in the 1970s, my father was quite skeptical about the cost. He also thought they had a lousy football team. Which was true. But it wasn't until I was able to line up for him on the kitchen table the letters of offer from University of Michigan and from Northwestern to demonstrate to him that it would actually cost slightly less to go to Northwestern based on the financial aid that was being made available. Now, not every school has the resources of a Northwestern, can offer admission on a need-blind basis, but not enough students recognize that financial aid does exist and that they should look wider in their college options because there may be a school that offers a particular course of study that they might dismiss because of the potential expense when it actually could be equalized.
But there may be something to add there, which is the issue of not only whether or not Northwestern has the wherewithal and the ability to pay, whether or not they have the political will to want to use the money for financial aid. So, Jim, when you were having that discussion with your dad, the issue wasn't just whether Northwestern theoretically could put the money on the table, but whether or not they really did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to pick up on that. And I, as a Northwestern graduate, I want to pick on another university. and let me pick on Yale for the moment. Now, endowments have taken a hit in the last year like everything has. But putting that aside, the 2007-08 year, Yale's endowment went up 25-27%. And they announced about a year ago, year and a half ago, that before the downturn, maybe it's almost 2 years now, that they were going to increase spending out of their endowment by $300 million a year, which was, well, I thought, a positive development till I read the fine print. They were going to increase student financial aid by $18 million. So what they were saying, out of every extra dollar of endowment money we're going to spend, we're going to spend a little over a nickel out of every dollar on the students. I did a little calculation. There are 5,000, 6,000 kids going to Yale College. What if they decided to say, we are going to become a free university? We're going to charge no student anything to go here, and we're going to get rid of our financial aid office. We'll save $3 million getting rid of our financial aid office. And we're going to become zero cost. They could have done that with just not the whole endowment, with the increased spending out of the endowment. For that 1 year, they could have gone to zero tuition. Harvard could have done the same thing. Princeton could have done the same thing. Even some private liberal arts college. A little Grinnell College in Iowa could have come close to doing the same thing. Amherst and Williams could do the same thing. A lot of colleges could. Now, maybe people with $100 million should pay something to go to college. I think you can make a case, and maybe going to zero tuition isn't right. But the point is, the undergraduate student is not the king, is not the priority at these institutions, and that is something of a shame, I think.
Well, I think part of the reason Yale doesn't do something like that, or Harvard, is because of their concern over the reaction of what they call their peer schools. when Harvard, Yale, Stanford made announcements about a year ago about improvements to their financial aid packages and Things such as a student from a family with household income under $60,000 will not pay a dime, and students with household income up to $100,000 will not take on student loans. There was surprisingly not really a universal acclaim for that from other universities, but instead a lot of huffing and puffing. Well, they've got the endowment, they can afford to do that, but you know, concern that that was somehow going to have this effect on other schools who you know, might have to actually think about how they can hold their costs down so they can charge less. And I think, you know, one can understand when certain private schools are charging what they do because that's what the market will bear. But then you also have to look at private schools, and I'll single out one in my home state of Michigan, Kalamazoo College. Well, it's I don't know the exact figure. It's between $40,000 and $50,000 a year. And the cost of room and board there is also in the range of, you know, of an expensive Ivy League school. And you have to think, well, are they, you know, does it really, is the cost of living in Kalamazoo equal to what it is in Cambridge? I don't think so. Does the cost of paying the faculty equal the same? I think they have to look seriously, some of these private schools that are charging such high prices, as to whether would it be smart for them to become a leader in reducing their cost, to, you know, look at some success stories in other industries, and to become, you know, sort of a Costco of higher education, where they can provide, you know, quality, but in a, you know, more of a big box type of setting, and convince people that, you know, we're going to give you a great education, but we're going to go a little bit bare bones in kind of the amenities we're providing. And your child's going to be taught by teachers who are experts in their field, and we're going to cut our costs for next year, and we're going to promise we're going to hold it down for the next 4 years so you'll feel confident that we're not doing a bait and switch on you. I think it would take a market leader school like that to, in order to create kind of a dramatic market-driven change to the way the system is. Otherwise, as Richard has alluded to, it's going to be incremental change, because there is a lot of hand-wringing in all sectors of higher education about what to do about this issue.
Let me just cut in here and remind our listeners that we're talking about the economic rationale for college. Is it worth it? My name is Jody Enda, and I'm here with Richard Vedder, Jim Boyle, and Steve Goodman. Steve, I think you had a point to add.
Oh, yeah, I really liked your point, Jim. I think that we can even go a step farther than that and look at whether or not universities ought to specialize in certain things. Why does every university have so many academic departments? Why does every university replicate the library facilities that are at universities 100 miles down the road? Maybe it makes sense to take a university or encourage a school like Kalamazoo to focus on one or two academic subjects and excel at those one or two academic subjects. So that way kids who care about that subject would then want to go to Kalamazoo rather than some other school. I don't think it does, as the United States and the world has become much more specialized. I mean, think about what we all do here. I mean, we're all specialists in our fields. I mean, it's really fascinating how we've come to specialize so much in our society. But I think that the universities have not gone along for the ride. Universities, in my mind, have not focused enough like a laser beam on those one or two or three departments that make them special. Perhaps Yale is different, perhaps Northwestern is different, but we have over 3,000 universities and colleges in the United States. And I think that we should, as a society, we should encourage some of those schools to focus, so that way there's a specific reason that people want to go there.
There's a lot of duplication of effort. There's a lot of, first of all, universities are run for the people who run the universities. Let's face it. I mean, I can speak from 45 years experience. I've been ripping off taxpayers for 45 years at a public university. I teach what I want to teach. And we have at my little school 20,000 students. We probably have 75 departments. We offer degrees we shouldn't be offering. We offer programs we shouldn't be offering. This is true across the country. I talked to a fellow at Oklahoma State University who came up with a, a little study for me called the $7,839 university, picking up on something Jim said. Let's have a bare bones university that's high quality. What would it cost to do it? Now, it may be, in fact, $12,000 or $15,000. And maybe we do want to have a climbing wall. You can't have a university without a climbing wall these days. And you got to have a few amenities for the kids. But we teach the typical professors in the classroom 150 hours, 180 hours a year. The typical American worker works 1,800 hours a year. So, and I would say the typical professor maybe spends 600 hours a year on instruction at a research university, a little more at liberal arts colleges. But, you know, we're spending an awful lot of our time doing other things. A lot of it's committees to because university governance is hopelessly inefficient and costly. Part of it is research, most of which is of inconsequential and trivial importance. So we got to change the model. And one way to do it is start from scratch and come up with new universities that do things. The for-profits have their problems, but at least they're out there doing something a little different. I kind of applaud them for their initiative. And we need to find new models, I think.
And Richard, you seem to be suggesting that the efficiencies are no better at public universities than they are at private ones, or no?
I've taught at both public and private universities. There isn't a nickel's worth. First of all, the typical private university, let's take the real prestigious ones. The most prestigious university in the United States is probably Harvard University. Harvard University gets more per capita public subsidies, counting federal subsidies, than does the University of Massachusetts in the same state. The privates, so-called private schools, get a lot of federal money for research and all, and that's one reason why they get diverted from the mission of instruction. The teaching function is pretty much the same at most of the schools. I think there are some subtle differences. I have a marginal preference for private schools and for a variety of reasons, but they're both nonprofit. They have no incentives to be efficient. They are in an arms race, as Steve argued. Leads them all pretty much, they have pretty much the same motives.
All right. Steve, can you talk a little bit about how parents can interact with college administrators when they're talking about college costs?
Well, I think the answer is gently and carefully, because I think that what a lot of families do is they come to my seminars, they listen to Jim, they listen to Richard, and then they say, oh, I'm going to go to the University of ABC and start negotiating tomorrow morning. And while I think that's healthy to think about that a little bit, you have to do this in a very delicate way. I mean, you're dealing with very savvy, very sophisticated administrators whose job in the financial aid office is essentially to give you as little money as possible. I think about financial aid officers a little bit like insurance adjusters, where they're always adjusting things down, not up, right? It's to their benefit to give you as little financial aid as possible. So you've got to figure out how to position yourself in such a way that they perceive that you would not go to that university but for a certain merit package that the university would give you. Now, of course, your follow-up question to that would usually be, well, how do you do that? And I spend usually 2 and 3 years with my students and families helping them to position themselves that way. But even if you don't spend the 2 or 3 years positioning yourself that way, what you do need to think about is, what do I offer the university? How does the university benefit from having me there as a 17-year-old or an 18-year-old? And if you're a parent listening to this, what does your son or daughter do, and what will they do when they get to campus to benefit the university? And why is it in the university's interest to give you guys a good financial aid package?
Jim.
A lot of aspects to this question. I think, first of all, it's important for a family to Steve has a book, which is a great title, and it's a wonderful book called College Admissions Together. And I think a first step in all this is for the family together to sit down at the kitchen table and to agree on what is important about the college education that the child is about to embark on, and then to look at various aspects of the college search process, including cost, and to have an honest discussion as a family about what is reasonable for that family to afford, kind of going into the process before the applications are submitted, so that that conversation is not occurring in April of senior year when the acceptances have been received and there's a ticking clock forcing the family to make a choice about what college the student should attend. So along as this process goes, then in terms of the conversation with the university, as part of the exploration process of college, I think a family, should feel emboldened when visiting a campus to ask, open and honest questions about where the money goes, why does it cost so much, what opportunities are there for financial aid, how are decisions made about financial aid. And then once a decision is made about where that the student should be the leader on and the parent hopefully will be supportive of, about where to attend, then to ask, another round of questions, very practical questions about how the university handles certain expenditures. I mean, the national healthcare debate is going on, so I'll bring up one as a for instance, and that comes to health insurance. The vast majority of college students are covered on their parents' health insurance plan, yet very few campus health centers actually accept that insurance as payment for service rendered. They conveniently stay out of network with the insurance companies, they being the campus health centers, and then say to the student and their parent, well, if you want your treatment to be covered here, you have to purchase our school-sponsored insurance policy. We don't accept Blue Cross Blue Shield, or we don't accept your United plan from your employer. And that, to me, is a real waste of resources and is one of those head-scratchers for parents thinking, well, for 18 years, they've been able to take out that insurance card for which they're paying and their employer are paying substantial premiums, and now they're at this facility that is supposed to be friendly to me because I'm part of the new university community, and they're not taking my insurance. So that doesn't make a lot of sense. So parents get frustrated by things like that that are sort of the legacy way of doing things for schools. Inertia sets in, things don't change, and parents, sometimes are hesitant to stir things up with their own child's university because for fear there would be some sort of repercussion on their child in terms of their grades or their financial aid package for the following year, et cetera. So part of what I try to do with parents is, yes, they should be respectful of schools, but they should also feel the absolute right and responsibility to ask questions of the university that their son or daughter is considering and attending.
Richard, you were a big proponent on the Spellings Commission for increased accountability for universities. What do you mean by that? And if I'm not mistaken, some commission members did not sign the recommendations. Can you tell us a little bit about the tension that went on there?
Well, everyone signed with the exception of the president of the American Council of Education, which is the chief lobbying group for American colleges and universities. But there was some tension. There's no question. I was considered, in fact, in the press, I was called the Simon Call of the Spellings Commission. At the time, I didn't know who Simon Call was, but having watched him, I couldn't decide whether that was meant to be a compliment or an attack. But
at least college students would know what you're
talking about. No. Colleges and universities are remarkably secretive. The irony of it all is colleges and universities are about the production and dissemination of knowledge. They're in the information business. But the one area of research, the one area where they don't want full disclosure, the one area of human inquiry which we are supposed to ignore, is about themselves. They don't want us to know how much money professors make. They don't want us to know what percentage of the budget goes to support certain programs that may have nothing to do with the learning experience or even the research experience of the universities. They don't want us to know about legal settlements that they've gotten into because of some impropriety that the university had to spend $2 million to buy off someone. They don't want us to know about those things. They don't even want us to know university president salaries, which are, in fact, usually a matter of public record or become one. That is one of the least problems we have. So we need more transparency in higher ed. And it also goes to one other area besides finances. It goes to what are the kids learning? What are the kids not only learning, but how is the college experience meaningful to them? Are they engaged? And that includes matters beyond the strict classroom type academic stuff. Are seniors, do they know more than freshmen? There's a group in Philadelphia or somewhere, Institute of ISI, Intercollegiate Studies Institute, that gives tests to seniors and to freshmen in history, economics, and so forth. And they found out, you know, the typical student at Yale University and at Duke University or a senior know less than the typical student or a freshman. So maybe you lose knowledge going to Duke. Now, I don't really believe that kids going to Duke are dumber, that Duke destroys knowledge. But you know, how do we know whether they're really learning anything? How do we know whether Yale had a good year in 2009? We have no way of knowing. We need to get those kind of metrics and information.
All right. You mentioned college president salaries. Why in the world are they so high?
Darned if I know. To be fair for a moment, it is a tough job running a university or a college. First of all, everyone thinks they're the bosses. The faculty think they run the university. Some schools, the students think they run a university. There's actually a school in Chicago where the students declared they did run the university, Scheimer College, and they're having a big fight up there between the students and the Board of Trustees. So that's a rare situation, but it happens. The alumni sometimes think they run the school. The trustees think they run the school. The legislature thinks they run the school. The governor, in the case of public universities. So it is a difficult job with all these competing interests, and the president of the university often has a near impossible job. University presidents should make more than truck drivers. University presidents should make a good salary. Maybe the salary of a superstar physician or certainly a good physician, a good lawyer, and so on. But salaries have gotten pretty out of control for university presidents. I think the last Chronicle survey just out shows that for a private research university, the salaries went up 15-16% this last year. Here we are supposedly in this horrible recession. Endowments are going down 20-25%. Unemployment is approaching 10%. And the university presidents are taking a big increase. So I do think the trustees of universities are taking some of this largesse, some of this money that's been dropped out of airplanes over college campuses, and they're giving it to themselves. And there's just a little too much of that going on. They're getting a little too greedy, and I think it's time to scrutinize this more. That's why I want transparency and accountability.
And I agree with Richard's comments. I mean, it's kind of interesting that even with all those changes, Richard, that you just mentioned, there are still now over 300 colleges that are sitting on endowments of over $100 million.
Sure.
Even with all of that.
Well, I think it adds to the cost. I mean, another Chronicle nugget that came out recently was the fact that in just 1 year, the number of schools with a total cost of $50,000 has gone from 5 to 58. 58 schools across the country now have a total cost, tuition, room, and board of over $50,000. These presidential salaries, Richard and Steve have hit a lot of good points. I would also add that it causes an elevation of the next layer of the administrators at the schools because, okay, president gets X, you know, pick out a number of $900,000. Well, you know, when you go to that Monday morning staff meeting and your CFO, who you rely on, and your chief academic officer, you know, are say in the 150 range, mm-hmm. you're thinking, you know, they really deserve a bit more. They're a key part of my team. You go to bat for them. And then you have five people that are making $300,000, and that raises the cost even more. And none of these people are actually then in the classroom teaching students. So I think the broad point is that there's far too much spent at colleges and universities that is not getting directly to the end user, the student in the classroom, which, you know, who is doing the learning that a university is supposed to be all about.
Given this frightening bit of news about the cost of American colleges, what about Canadian schools? Does it make sense for American students to look at Canadian schools, which I understand are less expensive than colleges in the United States? Steve Goodman?
Well, sure. I mean, well, interestingly, if you look at Canadian schools, in the last 10 years, there's been a 200% increase in the number of U.S. students applying and going to Canadian schools, not just for study abroad, but for degrees. And if I can take a broader view of that question, let's look at it even in terms of the UK. Since 2001, there's been an 80% jump in the number of full-time degree-seeking applications for undergraduate degrees in the UK. Now, not that there's anything wrong with the UK or Canada, but they are getting students from the United States who I think would not have looked at Canadian and UK schools had it not been for the cost. Now, perhaps some of them, you know, had dual passports from both countries, parents of dual citizens, but I think that a lot of that is due to cost. And those numbers are growing and growing and growing. We even see the Australians. Yeah. The Australians now actually have an education office in the embassy here in Washington. Now, they're not doing that because they have nothing better to do. They're doing that because they know that American students are spending a lot of money on education, and even if they charge half of what the Americans do, they can still basically generate a lot of cash for the educational systems and universities in those countries.
So, Steve, you see students and parents every day. Walk me through the process of what you go through with them to help them pick the right college and the right experience for them.
Well, I mean, generally, I try to figure out what students want and what parents want, and I try to help them figure out and understand where they're coming from. What are their objectives? And I guess this kind of loops back to the question you asked initially, which is, you know, is this a vocational thing? Is this a thinking thing? I mean, what's the purpose? Are we going to the University of XYZ because of the prestige? Are we looking at it because of the quality of the economics department? Are we doing it because it's near an airport? Are we doing it because they're giving us a big financial aid package? It really depends on who you ask. So some people come in and they want to play the money game. Like, for instance, I had a family last year where the mom and dad didn't see eye to eye the entire time. Basically, the dad just kept saying, well, how much is this going to cost? What's the final product? And I kept explaining to him that sometimes the more expensive private schools actually cost less if, in fact, that school comes through with a good financial aid package. The mom was focused on what the right fit was. And of course, the kid couldn't care less, you know, and the kid just simply wanted to go to a school and have fun and be away from his parents arguing about this. So, you know, but part of my job as an advisor is to help them through that.
So how do you do that? Tell us step one, step two, where do you go?
Well, I think we're going to run out of time because it takes about a year to do that. But
you can synthesize it in two sentences.
Well, what I try to do is I have a series of meetings with moms and dads and kids, and to try to work with them through this process. And I help students with essays. I help students with activity sheets. I train students for interviews. I help students to kind of figure out how to present themselves to universities. And for the families, I help, I think, to kind of calm down the stress by helping moms and dads to understand what's going on in the process and to kind of translate for them what's going on in the higher ed world in a way that is helpful for them as consumers.
Let's take a step back a minute and look at people who may be coming to you for advice in another 10 years or 15 years. 529 plans have been all the rage in recent years. Are these useful tools, and how should parents view these tools? Jim?
Well, timely. I just attended a panel session this morning on this very topic with folks from the industry. So I think that it's becoming more and more useful. There's certainly a greater percentage of parents of birth to 6 years old that are enrolling these plans than are currently, you know, at college or near college. So hopefully it's some relief in sight, I guess, in terms of families stay disciplined with savings plans such as this. They will have a greater nest egg built up by the time their child gets ready to go to college. Because as I like to tell families, there's three ways to pay for college: before, during, and after. And to the extent you can save and pay for college beforehand, then the pain will be much less during college. And then you and your student will be less likely to have to pay back a lot of loans after the fact. I'd say with 529 plans, though, it is sort of a buyer beware situation. Many of them that are the so-called prepaid college plans that have, you know, were created by state legislatures and set up in order to allow families to pay for college ahead of time, have changed the rules over the past 20 years, where they've decided, whoops, college has gone up more than we thought it would. And so therefore, you know, the amount of money you put in that you thought was going to pay for college isn't really going to pay for college. and are asking for surcharges or telling parents they need to put more money in order to cover the cost.
If I may add something
Please.
To that, I'm in favor of people saving money, and 529 plans have certain tax advantages and so forth. So you've got to be seriously interested in them. But one thing that's kind of aggravating, the family that is conscientious and saves a huge amount of money for college sometimes gets taxed on those earnings by the colleges themselves when they fill out the FAFSA form, as it's called. The government is the only the college is the only institution in the country that can go to their consumer and say, well, how much money you have, then we'll tell you how much we're going to charge you. And I think that that's borders. It's immoral. Its question is whether it's ethical. It's certainly legal. And because of that, if you've saved $100,000 up for college, maybe you'll receive over the course of 4 or 5 or 6 years, $30,000 or $40,000 less in government aid. So there is a tax on your earnings that is imposed by the colleges themselves.
That was Richard Vetter, director of the Center for College Affordability and Productivity. That draws us to the end of our program. Thank you so much for joining us for the first in a series of podcasts about higher education in the United States. I'm Jody Enda.